Mooney Goes Wild, celebrating 25 years on RTE Radio 1.
Hello and welcome to the programme. Today, Terry Flanagan checks out a daycation, not a staycation, a daycation, and spends the afternoon in a hide observing wildlife in Ballyfin in County Laois. We learn all about the otters on Dublin's rivers from Ross Macklin, and Richard Collins speaks with Eduardo Goncalves about his campaign to ban trophy hunting.
Trophy hunting is very different from other kinds of hunting. It is not subsistence hunting. It's not about hunting animals for food. It is not some kind of cultural, traditional right. There isn't any material need being met by it. It is purely an entertainment business, if you like. So it is killing an animal for pleasure, for amusement, and then taking a part of that animal and displaying it and keeping it as a trophy, as a symbol of your prowess, if you like, or of your achievement in having tracked and shot that particular animal.
That's pretty nasty stuff, that trophy hunting in studio today. We've got Niall Hatch. Niall, how are you today? All good, I hope.
Very good, thanks, Derek. How are you?
And Enid Nealana is here. Enid, that's pretty nasty stuff, that trophy hunting, isn't
it? Absolutely. Hunting is bad enough, but I mean, to be doing it just to have something on your wall that you killed and its corpse looking down on you. I wonder about the mental ability of people who do that kind of thing.
And if you look at some of the videos online, they're pretty shocking, I have to say. You see the guys just standing there, raising their rifles, taking aim and then firing at a herd of elephants. And it's just horrendous. For what? I mean, the elephants aren't doing anything. They're just doing what they do normally, just grazing. And these
fellas
just
come along. Think it's wonderful to have the skull of an elephant sitting on your walls showing that you did it. Or those tiger skin rugs that you see in old movies with the actual face of the tiger roaring on the mat and the people doing bold things on the rest of the tiger rug. Terrible, terrible carry on.
We want to know what you think as well. You can text about anything at all to 51551 or you can email Mooney at rte.ie. This is a quote I'm reading. This is an uncomfortable conversation that needs to be had in order for effective conservation measures to be devised. Or so said Dr. Barry McMahon of UCD. He's in front of us. What's uncomfortable? What's the conversation about? Who needs to hear it? And who needs to have it?
Oh my God, what a welcome.
just say yes. Just say yes.
Good evening.
Hello, Barry.
Thanks for having me. Essentially, I suppose it's about whether we should be culling or, you know, systematically removing predators that impact on our ground nesting bird populations, because as we found in our study, that if you're a ground nesting bird in Ireland or Britain or in Europe, you're more likely to be in decline than other species. All of the species were actually generally in decline, but you're in starker decline or in greater decline. And I suppose the logic behind our conclusions, if you like, in relation to the implications of the findings would be that because ground nesting birds are more likely to be predated by crows or by foxes, in the short term, it is absolutely necessary, if we want these ground nesting birds to persist in Ireland specifically, that we manage these predators.
Grant, so what's the problem?
People don't like killing foxes or crows.
Why not?
In general. Well, because, I mean, as I sort of said on other shows that I've talked about, I don't think any conservationist who's interested in ground nesting birds or who's interested in any particular conservation area wakes up and says, today I want to go out and I want to kill things. Whereas that might be what's required. So that's why it's an uncomfortable conversation. I think, by and large, most people who are not maybe in the business of conservation. So as you know, I'm in the business of conservation and I train people to think about conservation scenarios through a master's that we run in the School of Agriculture and Food Science. But, you know, this is one of the conversations that we would often have. People would come into the programme and not realise that there are really, really difficult discussions to be had around conservation. You know, conservation involves some level of conflict all the time. Ask ask Niall. He works in Birdwatch Ireland.
Niall.
Okay. Quite seriously, I don't mean to put Niall on the spot, but anyone who works in an NGO in relation to environmental issues, there's always some level of conflict. And this is one particular type where you're essentially saying that for the existence of this population, we need to remove these individuals of another species. And I suppose that might be a situation where you might say, well, you're making a judgment call that certain species are more important than others. Well, you know, we're like animal farm, all animals are equal, but some animals are more equal than others. Mm. But if you look at the Birds and Habitats Directive, that's exactly what it says. And I suppose, again, in relation to what we would have found, I mean, the co-authors that I have on this, Susan Doyle, Amy Gray, Sean Kelly and Steve Redpath, we would have all looked at this and said, like, this is a paper that's going to cause discussion. This is a paper that I'm going to end up...
Well, it has. Yeah. You're here.
Yeah.
So do you want to give me some examples then where the conflict is? Keep it simple, so.
Yeah. So, I mean, this, again, like, there would be a situation, say, for example, if you look at a really successful conservation program in Ireland, and you could look at, say, the terns, or you could look at, you know, both tern colonies, or you could look at, say, for example, a starker example would be the Grey Partridge Conservation Project down in Borah in County Offaly. Mm-hmm. It is very likely that one of the major successes, the reasons behind, the driver behind the success of that project has been systematic predator control, which is birds.
So let's start with the grey partridge first of all.
Yeah.
So it's a bird and it's a ground nesting bird.
Yeah.
Now, just to avoid any confusion whatsoever amongst our listeners, ground nesting birds are birds that build their nest on the ground and they lay their eggs in that nest on the ground. It's not high up in a tree. It's not buried in a hedge or in a wall. It's there in plain sight of the predators if they can find it. Okay. So these predators are going around at night and they're looking for food and... And they find these eggs and they munch on them. And why wouldn't they? And aren't they? Isn't it all about the survival of the fittest? So the ground, the grey partridge was, there was a conservation project on Borah Bog and you were trying to increase the numbers. The numbers had declined greatly. And so you brought some birds in there and you reared some. Isn't that correct?
That's correct. Yeah. It's an interesting project because it's where I, in some ways, I cut my teeth in terms of understanding how this process operates.
Yeah.
So... and where this is where the conflict sort of began, if you like, for me in terms of discussions with individuals who would be maybe, say, not from a rural background, from an urban background, who would have an interest in wildlife but wouldn't necessarily understand that you need to remove certain creatures for other creatures
to proliferate. So how much damage were the predators doing is what I'm asking you, really.
Just to bring it back, you've painted a very nice picture in terms of how these creatures are impacted by predators. What I'm talking about is in the short-term future, right? In the past, there's no doubt that the human alteration of the landscapes through agricultural intensification and specialisation has enabled a situation where these specialist ground nesting birds do not do as well as other generalist predators like corvids and foxes. Okay, so in the long term, it would be good to reverse or partially reverse the way in which those landscapes are configured or what they're made up of. So that would be the long term aspiration. But in the short term, you need to be able to remove the predation pressure that happens, as you described, because things like grey crows, foxes, magpies, these creatures do very, very well in human-dominated landscapes, which is what we live in. I mean, and the other interesting thing about this, Derek, is if you look back, and I'm sure Aine and Niall will vouch for this, if you look back, I remember a paper written by Allendorf, they said that, you know, we got to look at this logically. For hundreds and hundreds of years, there was coexistence between humans and biodiversity in landscapes, in farmed landscapes. So, and that's when people say, oh, it's about farmers. It's not. It's about farming policy and about the way in which those landscapes were altered that enables generalist predators to be able to create predation pressure that is causing the numbers that we see in the study that we
so you published. Have, sorry, Annie, just one moment. So just to clarify, so as I said, the birds are on the ground, and that was just an example of the grey partridge. The predators come around morning, noon or night, whenever they happen to be out foraging, and they eat these eggs, and then it can decimate the entire population of these birds that may only be confined to certain areas. That's what we're at here, like, because you mentioned terns as well, and the tern colonies are not all over the country. They're in certain parts of the country along our coastline, and there's predation happening there as well. So then you've discovered that the numbers are down in Britain and Ireland because of general predators like foxes or grey crows, whatever the case may be. And then you say if you control these general predators, then you'll have increased numbers in these birds. Is that what you're saying?
In the short term.
How do you suggest we control them, or do you get into that?
I would have no difficulty. So this isn't in the paper in some respects. There's lethal methods of control that are probably the most effective. So I'm talking about systematic, you know, lamping of foxes or using...
And is that where people get really upset?
Absolutely. And understandably so. Like, this is a conversation that... This is a communication process that needs to be really, really clear in terms of saying what we're doing, why you're doing it.
Who decides who lives and who dies?
That's a really good question, because that's something that we have sort of broached in terms of... Because that's getting onto a difference... That's getting onto a different discussion, because that's not a biological discussion. That's an ethical discussion.
Somebody has to decide, well, we're going to protect these birds. We're conserving these species. In order to conserve these species, we must take out the predators. That's it. I mean, so somebody has made that decision, presumably, because a license then has to be handed out for you to wipe out the predators. You can't just go willy-nilly shooting or killing or lamping, whatever you want to kill.
Well, this is one of the reasons that we would say in the paper that, and not only... that the birds directive doesn't really capture this issue at all. Mm. In conjunction with the fact that in Ireland, the birds directive has been shown to be really ineffective in relation to ground nesting birds. You can see it in the first figure. It's really, really obvious, right? So in terms of
what do you mean the first figure?
The first figure in the paper, sorry.
But we don't know what the first figure in the paper is. Tell us.
Oh, sure. Yeah. I sent this.
No, it's okay. No, we have it here. Yeah.
No, I know, but the reader, the person listening to this doesn't know what you're talking
about. That's absolutely... Aine, as I said, from the first time I've been on the show, Aine has always been keeping me grounded in relation to...
the listeners.
Don't stay on the ground for too long, because the predator comes in the house.
So basically, it would demonstrate that, like, any annex bird, so that's a bird that's important under the birds directive, the most important species.
For example, curlews.
No, they're not. They're not actually an annex species. So they're not. They probably will be, but but it's more like, say, the terns. Some of the tern species, or corncrake, would be an example. In terms of the, to go back to Derek's question, who makes the decision? The decision would have come under the Wildlife Act, I would say, to actually, that there's a situation where our national heritage is being, our biological heritage is being challenged. So therefore, you are allowed to be able to remove predators such as foxes or crows. I mean, foxes or crows are, there's a derogation under the Birds Directive that you can control.
Okay, but the bottom line is, the study you carried out between yourselves and the University in Aberdeen is that where there's general predators, that the ground nesting birds are being affected and their numbers are decreased because of that. Is that correct?
Well, what we would say is that it's very...
It's a direct correlation.
It's very, very likely that generalist predators are having an impact.
Okay, and you mentioned Nile earlier. So, Nile, you've got skin in the game here. Isn't that what they say?
I do.
You're NGO, Birdwatch Ireland. Tell me, so what do you do? What is the situation where you find the conflict? You're out conserving birds. Mm-hmm. Barry has mentioned terns, and I was out in Rockabill not so long ago, and I know you've got Kilcool breeding terns down there as well. So what do you do, and what problems do you face, and how do you get around it?
Well, it really is a very thorny issue, and it's very fraught, and there'll be people who'll never agree with it, and people who will say that there's no justification for a human ever killing an animal, and I understand that viewpoint. The problem we find ourselves in is that people say it's not right to interfere with nature. But the fact is, we human beings have interfered with nature beyond belief. Natural ecosystems in Ireland don't function the way that they should. We have a situation where we have these generous predators, as Barry's saying, like the crows, foxes and creatures like that, which themselves aren't subject to biological controls the way that they normally would be. And if they don't have predators to a significant degree who are preying on them or keeping their numbers down. And as Barry said, they tend to thrive in a man-altered or human-altered landscape. And that's causing problems for these birds. Now, if you look at birds like the grey partridge, for example, or the curlew or the corncrake or the terns, in a normally functioning ecosystem, you know, there'd be lots of those birds. They used to be abundant all around Ireland. And they could cope with the losses that these predators would inflict upon them. It wouldn't have a statistically significant effect on their overall population levels. It's got to a stage where some of these birds now are at such low levels that they can be completely wiped out as an Irish breeding species by the actions of just a few of these predators. And it's a horrible situation. You know, no conservationist gets into that line of work because they want to kill things. It's horrible. But unfortunately, it's the only way to save these animals. And I think that there is a moral obligation to conserve species where we can, to try and undo the harm that humans have caused to biodiversity and to the environment. And there's also a legal obligation under EU law to conserve these species as well. It's very difficult. And of course, nobody is saying that that creatures like foxes and crows should be wiped out as species. That would be just as bad. Mm. It's about redressing the balance. Unfortunately, it's we humans have caused that imbalance. It's not the foxes or the crows that have caused it, but we humans have caused it, and we have an obligation to put it right. And it's really fraught. It's horrible. Lest anyone think that conservationists get pleasure out of this, they don't. It's horrible.
We had a situation whereby the world was in balance. We had a population in Ireland that was Ireland's carrying capacity. We had our countryside covered, a lot of it in woodland, which was our native type of habitat. We had things like wolves that kept manners on foxes.
Yes.
We had things like eagles that kept manners on various smaller birds like crows and magpies. Magpies, in fact, only came here in the 1600s anyway. And then we didn't have the habitat. That's all stripped of cover and places and food for these things to eat. So then we have destroyed. So there's two things we have done. We've got rid of the top predators, which can only exist in small numbers because no predator can spend more energy getting food than it actually can, you know, spend energy getting food than it gets from the food. So you're never going to have millions of wolves. You're never going to have millions of eagles. But we've none. We brought the eagles back, I know, a little while ago, but relatively speaking. So your point in the paper is that there's no point in doing what the Habitats Directive says. Well, it didn't say that in so many words, obviously, but what you said was that restoring the habitat is too long of a game. We need a quicker game than this. By the time we restore the habitats back with conserved habitats, and because the Habitats Directive requires that we report on our good habitats every 5 years, and the National Parks and Wildlife Service over the last 15, 20 years have been giving them bad marks, bad marks, bad marks. We do not have excellent habitats getting better. We have miserable habitats getting worse in a lot of cases. So it's the game is too short. You say get rid of, we have to cull the predators because we have made the habitats too suitable for them. So it's not that we're getting rid of one species. We're never going to get rid of foxes. We're never going to get rid of crows. Mm. But what we're going to do is reduce their numbers to give the others a fighting chance, so that we have both rather than one or not the other.
Yeah, that's a reasonable sort of summation of what we put together. And again, like Derek said, who decides? I mean, what I have done, I'm a humble researcher in terms of we put evidence together, and you know, this is for policymakers to decide upon, what we really asked for is to say, look at what these findings mean in terms of it, current policies, national and European, are not functioning in terms of these particular, this cohort of species. And this cohort of species are probably the most, I would say, I mean, you'd probably be better asking Niall this, but they're probably the most emotive bunch of species. So things like curlew, corncrake, partridge, these are ones that generally get fire in the belly for the cohort of Irish population that are interested in biodiversity, which, judging by what you're saying about the state of the habitats in Ireland, there's not a huge cohort of Irish population that are really interested in biodiversity, or that I have yet to really see it.
It may emerge in the coming years. Certainly, the lockdown, the pandemic has raised awareness of the natural world amongst people for the reason that they were stuck at home or they were just out walking locally where they hadn't been before.
Well, but, sorry, Derek, just one point I would say about the pandemic. It's pretty clear, because another area of research that I'm interested in is zoonotic diseases. Hmm. Just to let your listeners know, and hopefully gets into mainstream media, it is absolutely well accepted amongst the people who are experts in this area that emerging infectious diseases in the last 40 years are as a result of biodiversity loss. Mm. So Ebola, Nipah virus, avian flu, SARS-1 and coronavirus are as a result of biodiversity loss. So they, if they don't care about it, they should start caring about it.
Yeah, well, we had Emma Teeling on last week talking about that. Well, partly that subject.
So Emma's a colleague of mine. So
absolutely. Biodiversity loss is one of the biggest threats facing us as a species. I mean, you know, we can be selfish about this as human beings. If we want to survive, we need to make sure that biodiversity is secure. And it really isn't at the moment. We're really, biodiversity loss is terrible.
Yeah, because you get the attitude in a lot of places, and I've heard it from my time in Ontashka, people are more important than birds. People are more important than frogs. And, you know, that if we look after wildlife, somehow humans will suffer in having to give space to them. Our wealth, our what we want to do, our development ability is curtailed by cranks like people on the Mooney Show who actually want to give space to wildlife. So once we have, and we still have that thing being peddled out there, you know, that it's a fight between them and us, between people who want to stop development, everything, you know, when you're really for something that's seen to be coming too late, to be important.
And sometimes putting your head above the parapet on this, you can get shot down. People react very aggressively. And I understand it. It's, you know, the idea of animals being harmed, it's horrible. But unfortunately, we humans have caused that enormous harm. The biggest killer of wildlife in Ireland is habitat loss. That's where our biodiversity has gone. It's got to the stage there where some species are brought so low that these predators, which are benefiting by, you know, being able to thrive in human environments, that they're able to wipe these species out, when in a normal functioning ecosystem, they wouldn't.
Now, you're managing reserves for terns, as I said.
Yes.
And you do have to control the predators there. So do you need a license to control the predators there?
Well,
do you have to prove to get that license?
Well, it depends on what the predators are. So when it comes to foxes, no, actually, a license isn't required for that. Under the Wildlife Act, it's not necessary. Having said that, I must stress that lethal solution is the absolute last resort. There are many cases where, for example, at Kilcool, we've been able this year to deter most of the foxes by using fox scaring lights. We have electric fences. It's absolute last resort. When it comes to controlling crows and corvids, they can be controlled under the Wildlife Act using things called Larsen traps, which are live traps. The birds don't necessarily have to be killed, and we use non-lethal control methods wherever possible. I just want to stress that. When it comes to some other predators, not ones that we've had to deal with recently, but if it was things, for example, let's say, hypothetically, bats or gulls or something like that.
Rats,
again, they can be controlled. If it's something like gulls that are causing problems, yes, licenses are required in those cases. That's not something we've had to face at the moment.
You don't need a license for a fox, but you need a license for a gull.
Yeah, because gulls are protected.
That's correct. Yeah.
Yeah, but foxes aren't.
A situation that personally I'm not very happy with is foxes have absolutely no protection of the Wildlife Act whatsoever, which is an issue. There's no legal protection afforded to foxes, which I don't think is right.
Or to rats or to mice.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
They're not protected.
With the rats are non-native species to Ireland. The fox is a native species.
Grey squirrels, all of those things.
Grey squirrels, American mink and
all
that.
It's an issue that's going to need a lot more time than we have now. Barry, so where do we go from here?
Well, I suppose in terms of European policy needs to look at this, and this has been picked up not just in Ireland but elsewhere, in terms of what we would say is that we need large-scale experiments to deal with some of the issues that Niall has to deal with, to say, like, maybe is there a gradient of which you need a certain level of predator management? If you have good habitat quality, you maybe need less predator management, whereas if you've got poor habitat quality and you still have cohorts of important species like curlew or corncrake hanging on, well, then you need greater levels of intensity. So that would be the next step in relation to this. The issue with this, Derek, as you'll see from the funding agency, I got funding from my school from this. This is not the type of research that people like to fund. So do you know why? Because it's an awkward conversation,
absolutely,
as I said.
Yeah.
So,
which came in the first place.
But this is something that really needs to be looked at. If you're interested in Irish grey nesting birds and look at the figures, it is quite clear that this is something that needs to be addressed. So that's where we would say it needs to go next.
All right. You can read more about this on our website, which is rte.ie/Mooney. Barry, thank you very much indeed.
Mooney Goes Wild, celebrating 25 years on RTE Radio 1. Visit the website rte.ie/Mooney.
Tomorrow night here on RTE Radio 1 in our second chance slot, we delve into the Mooney Goes Wild archive to give you an opportunity to listen once again to a documentary about white storks. In this clip, you will hear Carla Benson from the Stork Club in Rundstadt in Germany telling me how white storks construct their nests.
I don't know if you've noticed, the nests actually grow in height because every year the storks put a layer of nesting material on top of it.
Like an extension.
Yeah, sort of.
It only goes upwards. Does it go outwards as well?
It does, but actually it's really more that
it's
way.
It's more upwards.
But sometimes you can also see that they build against the wind, and then you can see that one side is sort of denser than the other side of the nest.
Well, they're not fools. They've been at this for a long time.
Yeah, that's true.
They've been successful.
Yeah.
It's survived.
Yeah. In order to keep the population stable, you need to have on average 2.2 young storks per breeding couple, and we are way below that. It's not great, and it's probably a result of the dry periods that we had, and we haven't had, for a few years now, we haven't had any proper spring floodings, and that's normally what fills in the pools and the wetlands. And they are all dry now, so there isn't really much in terms of frogs. Or
and do you think that's down to climate change, global warming?
Yeah, guess so, definitely, yeah.
Doesn't that sound wonderful? That's the clicking of the bills. They do a lot of that when they're on the nests. And when you go to these towns in Germany and Poland and across Europe, you see them really clearly and you hear them sometimes before you see them, just that click, 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 click sound. It's extraordinary. So that documentary tomorrow evening right here on RTE Radio 1. But right now, it's time to take you back in time to 1963. Remember this one? Thank you, Cliff.
We're all going on a summer holiday. No more working for a week or two. Fun and laughter on our summer holiday. No more worries for me or you for a week or two.
Yeah, it used to be about the summer holidays. Now it's all about the staycation. But where to go? What to do? How long to do it for? Is it a holiday you want or just a single adventure day trip you long for? Well, if it's the latter, there's already an abundance of activities out there, including skydiving, water sports, and mountain climbing, to name but a few. But if you're interested in wildlife, I think we have just the thing for you and the family. Terry Flanagan has more on this story. Terry.
Yes, Irish photography hides. Bet you haven't heard of that one.
I haven't.
No, well, Richard Duff. Richard's a farmer and he's in a beautiful spot down in the Midlands. And Richard has an interest in wildlife. And he's built a hide for himself a while ago.
Just now explain what a hide is,
Terry. A hide is a little kind of a room, an outdoor room. And it's where you can get into, sit in it and watch the wildlife outside. So he did that. That's what he spent his weekends at. Then he decided to encourage some more wildlife. So there's plenty of wildlife in that part of the country. And I suppose it grew from there. And now it's open to the public. And I thought, this is something I have to see. Not just the hides, but also the wildlife.
Now, Terry, come on over here. I'm going to go into this hide here. Right, this is just up on the top end of the field here.
Yes, it's next door you'll see Ballyfin Domain College, and we have a mature woodland just across the field at the other side of the wall.
So an ideal place to put
a hide. We have a lot of buzzards nesting here and red squirrels come over, and that's why I picked this corner.
Right.
And also we have an old lime kiln, which makes a lovely background for photographs.
Okay, well, let's go in and have a look.
Go in now.
Okay, Terry. So this one's not in use this morning.
No.
Oh, it's very comfortable, I'd say. And a toilet and all in it. Yeah. And, oh, that's really beautiful out there. Yeah. So we're just looking out now, and it's nicely camouflaged here.
Yeah.
We have a reflection pool there, and first of all, in front of us, that's it, just a pool, like a pond.
A little pond, yeah. For getting animals in a reflection pool, they come down to drink, and we have a light electricity in this hide as well, so we can use this hide at night time for night time shots with the reflection pool.
Now, I see you have bird feeders there as well. I can see the small birds there too, the blue tits there, they're just coming landing on it.
Blue tits, grey tits, you have some chaffinches.
So, Irish Photography Hides, how long are you in operation?
Since January this year.
Where did you get the idea from?
Well, it's just a hobby of mine. My first hide was built about 3 years ago. Mm-hmm. I used to go over there on a Sunday just to sit and relax and see the wildlife coming in. I have a stove and all of that hide. We'll go over there after this later on.
Right.
But there's people in it today.
But you've built it up into a business. It's no longer just a hobby.
Yeah, I suppose it just developed that way. I wasn't expecting it to take off as much. I've been watching hides over in Scotland and the UK on Facebook and online and how much people are going over there. I said, well, maybe I should try it.
And do many people come to you?
I mean, there was nobody here up to the 29th of June. And since the 29th of June, I was putting up pictures I was taking myself because I had to hide to myself, obviously, during lockdown.
And what's business like?
It's booked out 3 weeks in advance, every 7 days a week.
Really?
Yeah.
And the people who come here, are they locals or are they coming from afar?
They're coming mainly from all around the country. Mm. People are into wildlife.
And are they coming looking for some particular species?
Mainly the pine marten is the big one. They're very elusive.
Yeah. How many pine martens have you?
Well, there was a pair all winter. Now, they started to come in together then at the hide and they didn't seem to mind each other. But then at the beginning of July, the female was missing for about a month. I was hoping she wasn't killed on the road or something. But she came in the 1st of July with three kids.
Oh, lovely.
Yeah, I couldn't believe it. And that's when people really started wanting to come down and they saw
the
kids.
Sorry for cutting across. You know, there's a red squirrel there just walking across, trotting across that wall there.
Yeah.
He's just on his own. Do they come on their own or do you have more than one?
Well, this hide would be only one.
Yeah.
That's the first squirrel coming in here. But at the other hide, we've seen up to six at a time.
So your other hide is in operation today. There are
it
people
is.
There.
Yeah. So I've asked them, is it okay if I go over? So they told me to contact them first and see if there is something there. We'll have to wait.
Well, let's go over and see then.
Okay. Grand. Okay, Terry.
This sounds ideal for any photographer who's got a keen interest in natural history, Terry.
Yes. Now, that particular hide was one that he's just working on and it's built beside a lime kiln. And it's really, really beautiful. And he hasn't really got that many animals coming into it yet. So he's not really opening that one yet. But he had a second hide and he brought me to the second hide. And this is one that has been in operation for a while. And this is where all the action is right now. Now, Richard, we're coming up to your second hide here. We're coming through a field here, a crop. What's this crop?
Terry, this is a crop of what we call a wild bird cover.
Yeah.
I sow this every year for the wild birds and it's left there as food for them for the winter. As you can see, the blue flowers, that's the linseed. And the main part of it is oats and linseed.
And what happens? They go to seed and then they go to seed and
left
little flocks
the
of them leaving there. There's little chaffinches or something leaving.
During the winter time, you'll have about 1,000 chaffinches here. You might see 100 reed buntings.
Fabulous.
And maybe another 100 linnets and lots of pheasants.
Right, let's go down then and get into this hide.
No bother.
You have customers here already this morning, I know.
Yeah, they're here since 7:30 this morning.
Right.
The best activities in the morning.
Yes.
Yeah. Hi, guys. I'm Terry here.
On you go, Christian, on you go.
Hi.
How are you?
How you doing?
We're not going to disturb you for too long. I know you've been here since 7:30 this morning, is that right?
Early start, yeah, early start.
And what have you seen?
So far we've seen the pine marten, Eurasian jays, we've seen
the red squirrels.
Yeah, we saw the red squirrel earlier on as well.
Chaffinches, some blue tits.
And
there's a woodpecker calling in the background, yeah.
A woodpecker?
A woodpecker's calling in the background, you can hear him. We have a board app as well that identifies sound, so just to make sure we pulled out the board app and it confirmed it was a woodpecker, yeah. Okay.
Just looking out there to your... Oh, there's the red squirrel, look at him. See him back now? Oh, he's very black on his back, isn't he?
Oh, yeah. There he is. He's really healthy looking as well. If you have
isn't he? Real bushy tail on him there.
You know,
look at him. He's up on that plank. What's he got? A nut or something? Is that what he has? He's gone the far side there. Richard, can you see him there? I'm looking out the other side here now.
Yeah, there's a little...
He's gone, is he?
There's a tightrope to go across there. He'd probably go across to that other platform.
We got some pictures of him on the tightrope. He was, like, running across and then jumping. Some great shots.
And you have a little pond here in front of you as well, I see, just like the last one, Richard.
Yeah, well, a lot of the birds come in here in dry weather for drinking, and the red squirrel comes over for a drink, and if you're lucky, the pine marten will take a drink, and it's great to get up the close-up shots.
Okay. Yeah. Sorry, I didn't get your names anyway.
It's Mark.
Mark, you saw the pine marten.
We've seen the pine marten foresting this morning.
What was that like?
Yeah, there was two of them. It was my first time actually ever seeing one. It was good to see. It was something to check off my list that I had at the start of the year. So, yeah, it was nice to get that done.
And you have a fine big camera there with you as well.
Yeah, I use all Canon equipment.
And I'm looking at the lens that's on the ground here. It's about what?
That's a 500mm f4 prime lens.
Wow. And sorry, I didn't get your name either when we came in.
It's Julie.
Julie, what was your most interesting sight today?
Like, I've got some lovely shots now. I really did enjoy seeing the pine marten because as well as that, I've never seen one before. And they were coming up really close and, you know, they were doing loads of different expressions and, you know, they had their front paws up in front of their chest. And then the red squirrels here, they just look really healthy compared to some that I have seen. And then they were running along the
there's the back up. You see them out there in the field again? See them underneath?
Yeah.
Underneath the archway. You get a shot of them there, look.
They were running along the tightrope and then jumping from tree to tree, so we were able to get some moving shots of them as well. So.
And tell me, how did you hear about Irish Photography Hides?
Online, through Facebook, a lot of other photographers have been here, and we do a lot of travelling for wildlife photography, so we said we'd give it a bash to see what it was like, what all the hype was about. We weren't disappointed, we'll be back. Definitely be back.
Definitely.
Well, Richard, where are you? You're coming behind me here. Yeah. What do you think of that?
That's good. That's great. It's great to get good feedback.
Yeah. And I just walked in. As soon as I walk in here, I see the red squirrel. As soon as I walked into the last hide, saw a red squirrel. So there's plenty of wildlife.
Plenty
here.
Of activity, yeah. As I say, it's the noon time now, but most activity will be in the morning.
Yeah.
You know, so in the morning time, they don't have time to talk to you.
Well, they're looking at so much.
That's it.
How can people get in touch with you then? What's the easiest way?
Well, you can book through Messenger on Facebook, or you can email me, or send me a text, whatever. I have a website there as well, and all my details are on that.
Okay, well, we put it up on our website as well. Irish Photography Hides.
Irish Photography Hides, yeah.
Thanks for having me down today.
No problem, Terry. You're very welcome. Thank you.
Thanks very much indeed, Terry. It sounds like a lovely place to go and hang out for a few hours, especially if you're interested in photography. But getting those pictures so close. So, actually, I'm surprised that a nocturnal animal like a pine marten would be hopping around during the day. And I can tell you, I remember working for the BBC years ago, we went trying to film red squirrels on the Isle of Wight with no success.
Well, when were you filming them, at night or at daytime?
At night, the red squirrels during the day.
Yeah, because, the pine martens they're the natural predator of squirrels, and squirrels are a daytime species.
Well, now you have both out together by the sounds of it, so...
So you're both out together?
Yeah, if you go there... If you go to the hide there, there's grey squirrels.
They're obviously opportunistic animals, so they'll adjust their body clocks as to what's required. I mean, they're very efficient predators, pine martens, and they're very good at exploiting food
sources. But if the squirrels are their natural prey, and squirrels are only out during the day, well, if you want to eat a squirrel, you've got to go out during the day,
don't
you?
I think they're feeding them there, though, too.
Well, they could be doing that as well.
You know, but I'd just be afraid that if you do that, you could be interfering with their natural rhythm.
Mind you, pine martens have been getting a very bad rap in the press from what I've been listening to on other programmes. Because they raid hen houses, they're accused of raiding hen houses, and they come out at night and raid the hen houses and kill all the hens in the hen house to the fury of the owners. Mind you, foxes do that too, because the hens are trapped inside the hen house, and when the predator gets in, sure, they expect naturally that they all fly away and you only get one or two, so you kill until they're gone. But as you have a roof on the hen house and they haven't been able to fly away, they all get killed. And those pine martens and foxes come out at night to hunt. But then you see pine martens feeding on things like cherries, for example. They absolutely love cherries, and you know they'll do that during the day when they can see them. So I would imagine that they would be both fint hunting by day and by night. And if there's more food available in the daytime, well, why would you kill yourself at night?
I think when it comes to putting out bait for these animals to come and feed them, I suppose it depends on how suitable it is for them. So certain things like some fruits and nuts, they would be okay. One thing I do have a problem with is people who sometimes use strawberry jam to attract pine martens in. They're known to really love strawberry jam, which obviously isn't something they would find in the wild. And one of the problems with that is that it causes tooth decay because of the huge amounts of sugar in there, and a pine marten needs its teeth to be able to hunt and live a long life.
Basically,
so it shortens the lifespan. Yeah.
They are able to digest cherries, for example.
They are.
So they're not complete carnivores.
No, but the jam does pose a problem, and it's known that it does shorten the lifespan of pine martens because when they get older, their teeth are decayed, they're not able to find prey, and that has an effect. So baiting them, I think it's okay in many cases, but not with jam, I'd say.
No, hopefully nobody's doing that. You can email Mooney at rte.ie or you can text 51551.
Email mooney@rte.ie.
Now we're going to talk about trophy hunting. Trophy hunting is the killing of a wild animal for sport. The trophy is the animal or part of the animal kept and usually displayed to mark the success of the hunt. Those who support it say that much of the fees from hunts go towards wildlife conservation. Those who oppose it say it is cruel, immoral, lacks financial contribution to the communities affected, and can severely affect the health of a species population, as trophy hunting usually targets endangered animals. The most coveted trophies include elephants, leopards, rhinos and lions, as reported recently on Channel 4 News.
Tracked, cornered in the African bush, another lion is about to meet his end at the hands of a wealthy foreign trophy hunter. Another kill, and the lion's blood is smeared on their faces as part of the celebration. A century ago, Africa had around 200,000 lions, barely 20,000 remain. Lions are extinct in 26 African countries. Campaigners say trophy hunting is speeding them to oblivion.
Eduardo Congalves is founder of the campaign to ban trophy hunting. Earlier, he spoke with Richard Collins from his forest cabin in the Alentejo region in Portugal.
Trophy hunting is very different from other kinds of hunting. It is not subsistence hunting. It's not about hunting animals for food. It is not some kind of cultural, traditional rite. There isn't any material need being met by it. It is purely an entertainment business, if you like. So it is killing an animal for pleasure, for amusement, and then taking a part of that animal and displaying it and keeping it as a trophy, as a symbol of your prowess, if you like, or of your achievement in having tracked and shot that particular animal. And this is something that has grown into quite a major industry. So we now have very large numbers of animals, some of them quite endangered, which are being shot every year in every part of the world. So in Africa, North America, Asia, and so on and so forth. And it is something which arguably is helping to push some quite threatened species ever closer to that brink of extinction.
Does size matter particularly in this thing? I mean, if I shoot pheasants or duck or things, I'm not going for the biggest one around, but in this case, you seem to be going for the big ones.
Size really does matter when it comes to trophy hunting, and there's one big reason for that above all, and that is that there is something in the industry called the SCI Records Book. So SCI stands for Safari Club International. That's the main industry organisation. You know, hunters really strive to get into that. And in order to do that, you have to shoot the biggest trophies, the biggest animals of each species. So if you take the example of the lion, if you're a lion hunter and you want to get your lion trophy recognised and entered into the records book, it's got to achieve a score of 23. And the way that they come up with that score is that they measure the skull of the lion, so its length and its width in inches, add it together, and if it's more than 23 inches, then you're guaranteed a place in the records book. And the same system or principle applies for elephants, for rhinos, for all sorts of animals. In the case of elephants, what they do is they measure the two tusks, and if the combined weight is greater than 90 pounds, then you've got a place in the records book. With rhinos, they measure the horn at the base, so the circumference of the horn, and they also measure the length, and they add those figures together, and if it's over a certain number, then you're in the records book. So this is something that trophy hunters really strive to do. It is the ultimate achievement. Now, that has actually got lots of conservation implications, because if you're taking the biggest, the strongest, the fittest animals, if you like, out of circulation, out of the gene pool, you're leaving behind the smaller and weaker animals to breed and pass on their genes. And so you're seeing a process of genetic deterioration, or artificial selection, as scientists call it. And we're seeing that in the case of elephants. So the average tusk size of elephants has shrunk dramatically over the last 30, 40 years. We've also seen the size of lions. They're also getting smaller. And so it means that those species are more prone to disease. They're going to be less able to adapt to increasing environmental challenges. In the case of the elephant, for example, accelerating climate change is going to be a big problem because they need big tusks to be able to source water from under dry riverbeds in the drought season. And of course, we're going to be seeing ever more droughts. They're going to be fiercer, more prolonged. So that's another threat. You know, drought is already killing a number of animals in Africa every year. And unfortunately, the problem is going to get even worse.
Eduardo, if you were a wild fowler, you might raise mallard chicks or young pheasants and release them into the wild, a kind of canned version of wild fowling. In other words, you're artificially creating prey. Now, is there an equivalent? Are they raising animals in captivity, releasing them into the wild in order to shoot them? Is that more benign than going after the wild ones?
Canned hunting is a big and growing business within the trophy hunting sector. So if you take, for example, back in 1997, there was Roger Cook, who was the investigative journalist, had that wonderful TV program where he used to go around doorstopping everyone. And he did a program that went out in 1997, which was the first time the world knew about the existence of these lion factory farms in South Africa, where they're breeding lions specifically to be shot in enclosures by trophy hunters. At the time, there were maybe about a dozen of these facilities. Today there's over 300. There's something like 10,000 lions sitting in these cages waiting for somebody to come and shoot them. And you can literally order your lion off a menu. So you can contact a trophy hunting company and say, well, I'd like one with a light-coloured mane, medium-sized male, you know, and they'll say, yes, absolutely, we've got one of those in stock. Or maybe they'll even show you. And you then go down and shoot these animals. And the industry is now expanding into other species as well. So there's zebras, bears and leopards. And in fact, right now, there's actually a company in South Africa that's offering the chance for people to go and shoot captive bred tigers in enclosures. Now, one of the many problems associated with this industry, apart from the animal welfare aspects, and is that it's also fueling poaching. Because there's great problems of inbreeding within them. So in order to refresh the bloodline, refresh the stock, if you like, what these facilities often go and do is they nip over the border into Botswana and they shoot the male or the adult lions, and they bring back the lion cubs and introduce them back into their facility. And there's another aspect to this industry which doesn't often get talked about. And this is one of the reasons why it's helped fuel the lion hunting industry, because it's actually much cheaper than wild lion hunting. Not least because obviously it doesn't take as long to find the lion. You're not having to spend 3 weeks in the bush trying to track it and so on. And you've got to rack up all those costs of the professional hunting guide and accommodation and so on. No, the lion is just there in the enclosure. But apart from that, the cost is also subsidized by the lion bone trade. So what happens when a hunter shoots a canned lion is they take the head and the skin and they take that back to their taxidermist, who transforms it into a trophy. Then the bones are sold off to Asian dealers and they're turned into lion wine, lion cake, and other so-called medicinal products or status products, which are increasingly popular in the Far East. And so the growth of that market is being fueled even further by the growth of this canned hunting industry.
Now, the whole thing revolts me, I have to say, Eduardo, but I have to act as devil's advocate here. And people who approve of this dreadful practice would say that they are helping to conserve species because it gives local people in these countries a vested interest in preserving their wild creatures. They're making money out of it. How would you deal with that argument?
There's many ways to answer that, and the bottom line is it simply doesn't stack up. Let's talk about the example of Cecil the Lion. It's exactly 5 years almost to the day since Cecil the Lion was shot by that American dentist, Walter Palmer, and a lot of people will remember that. Now, Walter Palmer will have paid about $30,000 of his total fee as a trophy fee, and that trophy fee is payable to the government. It goes into supposedly the Environment Department's coffers to support conservation. Now, Dr. Andrew Loveridge, who was the Oxford University scientist who radio-collared and tagged and monitored Cecil throughout his life until he was shot, he brought out a book a couple of years ago talking about his experiences of working with lions there. And he said that, well, look, the cost of actually conserving a lion like Cecil and his habitats and so on, is going to be about $1 million over his lifetime. Well, $30,000 obviously doesn't come anywhere near that. And what he said was that actually what does help to generate the funds and, you know, incentivize people to conserve habitats is actually nature tourism, photographic tourism and so on. So a lion like Cecil can, on his own, generate the equivalent of around $100,000 a year. So, you know, multiply that by the average lifespan of a lion in the wild of around about 15 years, and you can see that the sums clearly indicate that if you want to conserve wildlife and you want to find a sustainable use, a sustainable business model, then actually nature tourism is going to be the answer, you know, pretty much every time. And the same applies when it comes to jobs and you know, giving an incentive to local people. You know, local people were absolutely furious when Cecil was killed because he was bringing in money to the local community through nature tourism, and suddenly that was cut off. And there was a study published earlier this year, in January I think it was, which showed that if, for example, South Africa, which is very much the hub of the African hunting industry, if it were to switch wholesale from trophy hunting to nature tourism, it would create 11 times as many jobs for people in poor rural communities. So there'd be less incentive to poach, be less incentive to go and kill animals for bushmeat, it'd be less incentive to transform land into farmland, and so on and so forth. So the evidence that we have, and this is from IUCN, from the UN World Tourism Organization, from the UN FAO, and even from hunting organizations like CIC, they all say that actually, at the end of the day, the best way to generate revenues and motivate people to help conserve wildlife and their habitats is actually not through trophy hunting, it's through nature tourism.
It has not been a pleasant business talking to you, Eduardo, but it has been a fascinating one. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mooney Goes Wild, celebrating 25 years on RTE Radio 1. Visit the website rte.ie/Mooney.
Needless to say, yeah, lots of people very annoyed about trophy hunting. Aina, you wanted to say something
else? The ultimate trophy. The ultimate trophy that you want to have in your wall is the photograph that you took. So out there, doing all the things, tracking the animal, finding where it is, but getting the photograph. I mean, why would you want to kill it? I mean, that's the ultimate thing. And you can do it with a lens from here to Cork, or you can do it with a pocket camera, which must be the ultimate trophy altogether. You were saying about photographing animals in the Himalayas.
Oh, there was a gentleman, yeah, who got some really famous photographs of snow leopard. He's a local shepherd, I think, and they want to know how he got such good photographs in Nepal of these animals, and apparently he was going right up to them, shaking the snow leopard awake, taking a picture and running like hell.
So therefore the nearer you get, so therefore your ultimate trophy should be the most wonderful picture with the smallest possible camera. And that would actually give all
that
the trail of seeing.
Only shot.
And that should
be
the only shot, exactly.
Okay,
indeed.
Aina, thank you very much indeed. And thanks also to Niall Hatch. Our broadcast coordinator is Jarlath Holland. Our researcher is John Bella Riley. On sound today, we had Tommy O'Sullivan. We'll do it all again next week. In the meantime, please do visit the website rte.ie/Mooney. Until next week, bye!
Visit the website rte.ie/Mooney.